So for today's talk, you know, carrying on from everything I've been saying so far, it's a nice addition to what I was saying yesterday when I was talking about Anapanasati and the different stages and how they morph one into the other, to give this other description about meditation, which I always give when I teach 9-day retreats, and that is on the South St. Pedro Lotus Simile. It's a lovely place to start. And it has many advantages, this South St. Pedro Lotus Simile. And one of it is it shows you how to meditate very simply, and what happens in meditation, and what not to do in meditation. And then, I don't know if it'll take all that 1 hour, but then afterwards I'll start to talk about the insights which comes along with the meditation practice. The insight is the new ways of looking and seeing which comes with the practice of meditation. You're not learning more facts, you're just refining the way you see and understand and feel things. Instead of actually growing in knowledge, we're just growing in the power of our ability to see, to discern. So, we start off with the South St. Pedro Lotus Simile. A lotus has always been a very key symbol of Buddhism. There's always a lotus somewhere in a Buddhist temple. And it has wonderful similes. You have also, you know, the simile of a lotus grows in the mud. And then we all sort of grow in difficult situations. It's never easy for any one of us in life. And as we grow, the good lotuses, the powerful ones, they grow up through the water, past the mud. But the mud is always the source of their sustenance. And some of the lotuses break through, and break through the surface of the water and can reach the sunlight. So even each one of us always born in difficult situations, and that's part of the nature of human life. But that difficulty, that degree of suffering is important as the fertilizer, as the sustenance which drives us up towards the light and through that barrier, the surface of the water, so we can actually be in the sunlight. The other simile of the lotus, which I have mentioned but not in detail, was a simile. It's a nice thing to imagine or to visualize in your life when people are criticizing you or when they're praising you, the praise and blame thing. Because a lotus is something which, when the water falls on its petals, the water always drips off and it leaves no residue. So if somebody urinates on the lotus, then the lotus doesn't keep any of that urine. It all drips off. And if you smell the lotus after it's been peed on, you'll find it has no residue there. It still smells like a lotus, not sort of like a urinal. And it's the same if people pour perfume over that lotus. It all drips off and it leaves no residue. So in the end, the lotus is still smelling like a lotus. And it's a beautiful simile because each one of you, no matter who you are, will always receive a lot of criticism. Some of it is deserved, most of it isn't. And I say most of it because how do people know who you are, what you do? But if it is deserved, fine. You know what Ajahn Chah used to say about criticism? In the northeast Thailand, actually many countries, the worst thing anyone can call you is a dog. Ma. The nice word for dog is sunak in Thai, but ma is really just quite a bad word for dog. And anyway, if somebody calls you a dog, Ajahn Chah used to tell me, then don't get upset yet. The first thing you should do if somebody calls you a dog is to look at your bottom. See if you've got a tail. If you haven't got a tail, then you're not a dog. End of problem. If you have got a tail, then say, thank you, sir, you know, for pointing something out to me which I've forgotten. In other words, most of the time you don't need to react to criticism, just look at your bottom, see if you've got a tail. And that also reminds me of how that works in practice. This was a story I've told many times. I saw it in one of those books from the Ahipasako in Indonesia. The story of when we first went to, when I first arrived in Northeast Thailand, the Vietnam War was still on. But they used to have a US Air Force base close by to Ubon, but it closed down just as I came to stay in Thailand. And anyway, when that US Air Force base was in action, one day there was one of these Afro-American soldiers was in a rickshaw being driven from the base into town. And halfway on the journey, the rickshaw driver passed some of his friends who were by a roadside bar getting drunk. And because they were drunk, one of his friends shouted out, "Where are you taking that dirty dog to?" pointing to the soldier. And this Afro-American was quite large. And the driver was really, really afraid. That was abuse, calling him a dirty dog. And he looked at the soldier. The soldier was just looking at the scenery, just smiling. And so the driver thought that the soldier doesn't understand the local Isan language. So he shouted back to his friends, "Look how dirty this dog is. I'm taking him into the river in town, throwing him in for a good wash. Ha 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 ha." And the soldier was just looking at the scenery and smiling all the time. He didn't fight. He obviously couldn't understand, so they thought. When they got into town, the soldier got out of the rickshaw and walked away without paying. And when the driver demanded, "Money, money, you've got to pay me a fare," the soldier turned around and said in perfect Isan language, "Dogs don't have money." Ma, money, earn. Which is a lovely way of teaching that rickshaw driver. And don't use bad speech against anybody. But you can see there that it was like the lotus. All those bad words could drip off that soldier, and he didn't react. And nice words you hear, again, let that all drip off so it doesn't. You don't react. So that's like the idea of being a lotus. You can be in arguments, you can be where people are cursing you, praising you, whatever. You can't stop it happening, but at least you can let it all drip off you and walk away, leaving no residue. That, by the way, is one of the explanations I use for one of the four ways of letting go. It's called anālaya. Nothing sticks to you. So things happen in life, you get beautiful meditation, you get terrible meditation. Neither belong to you. Everything just drips away. And afterwards, you're still peaceful. You hold on to nothing, you keep nothing. But anyway, the main simile of the thousand petaled lotus was a simile of knowing how lotuses open up. You look at a lotus at night time and it's all closed up. And if you see that lotus closed up at night time, you look at the outermost layer of petals. It's not really a petal, it's like a sheath. It's thick, and the ones I see are usually corrugated to make it stronger. And it's those outermost petals which take all the damage of the wind, the dust, and anything else at night time. It protects what's inside. And in the morning, when the sun comes up, it is the light and the warmth of the sun on the outermost sheath of that lotus opens it up. the lotus opens. You can't peel the lotus open, that would just damage it. You wait for the warmth and light of the sun to open it. And that reveals the next layer of petals. Actually, the first real layer of petals, which are usually got the colour of the lotus, got some fragrance, but are still quite thick. The warmth and light of the sun, as I've mentioned to you before, stands for the kindness and the mindfulness. The warmth is a kindness, the light is a mindfulness. So when you look at your body and mind with kindness and mindfulness, you can actually see it and you're kind to it, you'll find that your body will relax. It can relax really deeply. And when it relaxes deeply, that's when the body can disappear. And you can go inside it, to the world of the mind. But if this body is still painful, active, doing stuff, of course, you know, you can't really be aware of your mind. Sometimes people confuse the thoughts about the world with the mind. That's not the mind, that's just almost like the echoes of the five sense world. The echoes of the body. You know, what you're going to have for dinner, how long you're going to sleep, what you're going to do after the retreat, and blah, blah, blah. But really, once the light and the warmth of the sun sort of shines on the outermost petal of your lotus, your body, long enough, soon the body relaxes, disappears, and you're really peaceful. By which you mean, the body just vanishes. You've gone inside to the first layer of petals. And to be able to go inside the first layer of petals, real petals of the lotus, again, use the kindness and the mindfulness. Just stay there and see what happens. And then you tend to go into what we call the center of time. You go into the present moment with mindfulness and kindness. One thing I would emphasize here, sometimes when I'm talking, I often just have to pause because I'm about to say, one thing I would like to stress about this simile, but we're not supposed to have any stress in Buddhism, especially in meditation, so I try and use the word emphasize instead. So I stress that point. But anyway, you're emphasizing that with our mindfulness and kindness, that's how you go into the present moment. Again, I remember talking with many meditators. Present moment, yeah, we know what it is, but I can only get in the present moment for a moment, and then I'm off in the past and the future again. How can I let go of the past and the future? And I want to. I realize I don't need to be in the past or in the future, but I just can't do it. And it's that addition of kindness. It's that last missing thing which helps you let go of the past and the future. I don't know what you did yesterday. Did you have a perfect day yesterday? Did you make some mistakes? Did you break any of your precepts? Did you do something wrong? If you don't have this beautiful kindness, which includes forgiveness, you can't let it go. It'll keep bothering you, keep coming up. But if you give it the kindness, it's amazing how easy it is for these things to vanish. Which is a good introduction to one of the other wonderful similes. This was taught by the Buddha, elaborated on by you-know-who, me. Which is a wonderful solution to when you're having a lot of difficulties in the meditation, or you're thinking of stuff in the past and it's very unpleasant, painful, or just not really what you want. And it's a simile of the monster in the Empress's palace. Many of these similes I have alluded to either in the talks, the question and answers, or in the private interviews. But nevertheless, it's good to put it in the context of this talk because it's powerful and it's relevant. Once there was an empress. And she was so lucky, without any preferences, she managed to get into one of the retreats at Jhana Grove. You know, sometimes you do get famous celebrities on retreats. I remember just once, a long time ago, when we used to do the retreats over in North Perth, in the Redemptorist Monastery. And there were so many young Thai men coming on this retreat. And some of them I'd never seen at monastery, and I thought, wow, it's amazing that at last many of these young Thai men have seen the importance of developing their mind in meditation. And I was very inspired. Until someone actually told me that on that retreat there was a famous Thai film star who decided to come on my retreat over in Perth because she's going on a retreat in Thailand, she'd be swamped. So she came on my retreat. And that's why all the young Thai boys were there. They weren't interested in watching their breath. They were watching something else most of the time. It's human nature. But another guy, and it's not one of my retreats, or at least they haven't told me this, it could have been the case, but no, Kate Moss, she's some supermodel. She goes on retreats. And one of the guys who came on my retreat said that he went on a retreat and he heard that Kate Moss, this supermodel, she was on that retreat as well. And he couldn't help himself but, you know, during the retreat, open his eyes and have a look at everybody. Which one is Kate Moss? And he said a very interesting thing, reason why I tell this story. He looked at everybody, because they had their eyes closed, he could have a peek, and they didn't know that he was looking. He couldn't find her. She was there, he'd seen her many times, but he didn't know that that particular woman was Kate Moss. And the reason was that her special characteristics, which made her stand out from others, was she had such an ordinary face. The makeup artists, the people who dressed her, who did her hair or anything, they had this almost free range to make up this image of beauty. In real life, she was quite ordinary. And I kind of like that idea. So much of what we think is beauty, strength, what makes another person attractive, is actually added on. It's not the real person at all. Anyway, I also remember one of our... she was actually the vice president, not you, Xena, this Judy, a long time ago. She wanted to go and see the Dalai Lama over in India. And because she was the vice president of the Buddhist Society of Western Australia, she got an appointment to see him. But she had to wait a couple of days. And as she was waiting and waiting and waiting, they always had meditation in the mornings in the temple there, so she got there early in the morning, sat down, started meditating. Somebody came and sat in the seat next to her, and she made a big mistake of looking, see who it was. It was Richard Gere. And that was the end of her meditation. She said, I could help myself. Human beings. But anyhow, so when we are praise and blame, and people have got a famous name or they haven't got a famous name, that's just all. Perfume off the lotus. If you're notorious, again, pee off the lotus. So, in other words, you don't keep anything, so you can be free. But anyway, in the Thousand Petal Lotus simile, after a while, with kindness to the past, you forgive everything and you realize there's always something to gain from whatever happened to you in the past. You've got a choice. You can't change the past, but you can change the way you regard it. You can be negative about the past, or you can just think that this is a wonderful fertilizer. You know, I always say about that, if you tread in the dog poo, take it home with you and dig it under the mango tree. The origin of that simile, within the monastery in the north of Thailand, where I spent a year, and the first year after, you know, I could leave Wat Pa Phong, because I'd done my basic training of 5 years. And in there was a cave, it was a beautiful cave, and I used to spend so much time in that cave. And again, that's where the smell of bat poo became one of my favorite smells, because I associate it with the happiness of those meditations. But also, right outside that cave, the very front of that cave, there was a single tree. It was a papaya tree. And that would get all of the poo from the bats as they flew out, and all the poo when they came in. And so that was such rich soil. And I think many of you know that I don't usually eat much fruit, but that particular papaya tree, to this day, that still is the most delicious papaya I've ever eaten. Every time I saw a fruit get ripe on that tree, I could not pick it myself, that's against my monastic rules. But because I studied the Vinaya, I know all the loopholes. So I'd take one of the lay people and say, "Oh, look at that papaya up there." And they know what I meant. And I ate the whole thing. It was so delicious. Because I realized what I was eating. What was I really eating? Bat poo. Transformed into this delicious papaya. These anecdotes, they're real, they're true. So if, you know, you have had some difficulties in the past, see the benefits of them. There's always some benefits in there somewhere. And when you can see those benefits in them, then you are using the bat poo or the terrible experiences with kindness, and you can let go of them so easily afterwards, no matter what happened to you. That's how you let go of the past, by being kind to it first of all, and kind to all the beings and people who were in that little play, that act of, you know, your past. And that also encourages you not to be afraid of the future. It's amazing that when you're a monk, you lose your fear of the future. It's always, you can see something positive. Even I was telling the people over in Hong Kong a few days ago when I was teaching there. Now we start flying again now, and COVID is not much of a danger anymore. So you can get on those aircraft and just fly all over the world to teach. But they said, "Aren't you afraid, Ajahn Brahm?" Because, you know, you fly over Ukraine or over Georgia, and there are missiles going all over the place. Even you fly, you know, to South Korea or to Taiwan, and again, there's missiles going all over the place there. The world's not a peaceful place. So they asked me, "Just, aren't you afraid of dying in an aircraft explosion?" And my answer, "Why should you be afraid of dying in an aircraft explosion?" "There are three benefits of dying at 30,000 feet. I've said this before, but because I haven't flown for a while, I started talking about it again. The three benefits of dying in an aircraft explosion at 30,000 feet. One, instant cremation. You know how hard it is to arrange somebody's burial or cremation? Burials are really difficult these days, but even cremation. You've got to ring up the funeral director and find a spot in the crematorium when everyone can come. People have got to take time off work. And if this is done in places like Hong in Chinese culture, you have to have a big feeding of people for days beforehand. You don't know who is actually coming in to get fed. You have to let everybody come in and get a free meal. And you spend so many time off work, it costs a lot of money. And then eventually when you actually do get to the funeral and do the cremation. Everyone has to take time off work and it's expensive, and you know, say all these things about the person, and then eventually it's finished. It's a lot of work. If they die at 30,000 feet, it's done on the spot. Really efficient. And when people want to know, what should we do with their ashes? Oh, that's another problem people have. Can we bury them here, scatter them there? Aircraft explosion, they're spread on the spot, scattered. So that's number one. It's so efficient. Number two, how expensive are funerals? They are extremely expensive. Sometimes, you know, I'm surprised not more people die when they get the bill. And I've got to don't tell the joke, Bob. It's not a joke, it's more like a true ghost story. Here it comes. Now this was, you know, I do many funeral services in my life, and one of the funeral services which I did was just a burial. I think it was over in Fremantle Cemetery. And I've done this many times. The plot for the Chinese Buddhists is a long walk from the entrance. It's a long distance. So I knew it was a long walk. And so, you know, as the monk, I was walking next to the funeral director leading the cortege, the procession. And so you're standing in front. So I decided to ask the funeral director, said, how long have you been in this business? And she said, oh, about 20, 30 years. I said, oh, great. Have you got any good ghost stories? She said, yes. And she was being honest with me. And said, well, tell me one. Because we had a long walk. And she said, because she was the manager of, you know, one of these big funeral parlors, she said, sometimes I have to work late at night. When I'm in the office alone, late at night, only one in the compound, sometimes, you know, the door of my office is open and I see someone walk past. I mean, a ghost. I said, yeah. What do you do? I tell him, get back in your box. That's what she says. She's not afraid, it's just, you know, some of the ghosts having a bit of exercise in the evening. Get back in your box. Stop messing around. That's to get back in the box. Anyway, 1,000 petal lotus. So when you're kind to the past and the future, you're not afraid at all. Which means it's easy to let things go. You don't have to worry about the future. When I was young, actually when I first came to Perth, the monk I was with insisted that we drink a lot of miso, you know, miso soup, the Japanese soup. I said, why? He said, because he was sure there was going to be a nuclear war. And miso soup was supposed to protect you from radiation. He was my senior, so I had no choice. So I drank a lot of miso soup. It was okay, but I prefer a cup of tea, but I had to have miso. It never happened. But if you are afraid, you make things happen. One of the other things I do is every year, the last 33 years, every year I've been going to give a talk at the cancer, it used to start off as a cancer support association, and now it's called Solaris Cancer Care over in Cottesloe. And every year I go there, even when they manage to secure some funding, the bigger, really big complex from the state government. At the opening ceremony, they invited the Premier of Western Australia, big shot. He was the first VIP. And the other one they invited was a VIM. Me. Very poor monk. And I was really quite surprised. You know, why me? You know, I'm not sort of a big shot in the political community. And they said, you've been coming every year for ages. And so, you know, you're one of the most important people for us in the Solaris Cancer Care. And so when I did the blessing with the holy water, I did ask permission from the bodyguards. I was allowed to bless the premier with holy water to give him a good soaking. But anyway, why? You invited me. And they said, the first time I came there, first time I went there, one of the women there, who was a survivor of breast cancer, she asked me a question. And she said to me, a simple question, I've survived breast cancer, it was really, really painful and difficult, but I'm afraid, what will I do if it comes back again? You know my answer? What would you do if it doesn't come back? And that shocked her. The cancer never came back, but she comes back every year to see me when I go there. She said there was something about that answer which really sort of shook her. And I explained afterwards, if you're afraid it's going to come back, you've got tension, fear, and that is the cause of many cancers. The more afraid you are of it coming back, the more you increase the chances of it coming back. But if you're not afraid, you find it doesn't come back at all. You relax, you're at peace, you're changing your attitude to life. Same as that Anita Murajani, worried about what other people think of her. She was afraid of what other people think of her, afraid of criticism, afraid of not fulfilling what they wanted of her. It's a fear-based cancer. So when you don't have any fear, it doesn't matter what people think of you. As I say, they're not thinking about you anyway most of the time. And if for some reason they think, well, I've had enough of that vice president of the Buddhist Society, she never does anything, she does this, and they talk stuff like that. Ah, you know what you're doing a good job, so that's good enough. So you're not afraid of the future. When you're not afraid of the future with wisdom and kindness, it's so easy to let it go. How many of you are going to die? I go to so many airports, of course I've got terminal disease. But anyhow, you're not afraid, just see what happens. So that degree of kindness and wisdom means the past and future, time disappears. Like the petals open up. The present moment is right in the middle of time. And each one of these different layers gets more beautiful and more fragrant and more thin, the petals. They get more subtle and more pleasant to look at. And the fragrance increases. And then right in the middle of the present moment, sometimes I just stay in this present moment. And the next thing I notice, I'm silent. There's nothing much to say about now. Most of the conversations are about what happened in the past, what might happen in the future. You can't say much about what's happening right now. So after a while, you get silent. You can fantasize, but fantasize is like dreams of the future, or memories of the past. But this present moment, it's really in the present moment, the silence comes so easy. Why talk? Even if you do talk, what a beautiful sunset. What you're really saying is, What a beautiful sunset that was a second ago. There's that time delay. Right now is where the beauty is. Imagine you were listening to some music, you know, some, I haven't heard this for years. One, just before I became a monk, the type of music I loved was like Monteverdi. It was like, call it chamber music, maybe. But it was just so beautiful, and I really got into it. But you can't have past or future when you're listening to great music. You have to be right there in this moment to really appreciate it, because it changes so fast. So right in this moment, you can appreciate it, enjoy it. But then, you see that you're coming into the present moment and into silence. When you have that silence, it's like the thousand-petal lotus is really opening out. You're going inside of it. Silence is in the middle of the present moment. Present moment is in the middle of time. Time is in the middle of your mind. So once you actually, and the mind is in the middle of your body, you always tend to feel like you're going inwards. And that's an important point, because for so many people we feel we have to go onwards. When you go to school, you go to the next level, you go onwards. You don't go backwards. In meditation, you don't go onwards, you don't go backwards, you go inwards. Right in the center of silence. As I pointed out, and many of you experience this, you experience the breathing. It's like the present moment has opened out, silence has opened out, and right in the middle you can feel your breathing. Breath just coming in, going out, just doing its thing. You don't do it, it's just the nature of the body. And if you do it that way, you don't go looking for the breath, but you're actually experiencing the breath. Naturally, it always gets very beautiful. The deeper you go into the lotus, the more refined are the colors of those petals. And again, the fragrance is deeper, more powerful, more beautiful. So you're watching the breath. And the reason I say this simile now is people ask, yeah, I'm watching the breath, now what do I do? I don't. It's like those little kids. Have we got there yet? Have we got there yet? Is this jhana? Is this nibbana? So instead of thinking like that, here we are, enjoy it, be with this. Be mindful, be kind. And then you'll find those petals open up. In the middle of the breath, you know what you find? The delightful breath. The way the mind sees the breath. You know, sometimes, even a few days ago, one of our Anagarikas, you know, he's no more, he's gone. His name was Jake. And we gave him a novice ordination. He's now Dayalu. And he's sitting at the end there. But honestly, when a person becomes a novice, they start wearing brown, or a samaneri, they look different. Now I've got reasonably good sight, even though I need glasses, but nevertheless, you know, there's a difference there. And that's like when you see the breath by feeling it with that fifth sense of physical touch. That appears like one thing. When you experience it with your sixth sense, your mind, it's the same thing, but it appears different. There's different textures to it. And that's one of the reasons why when your mind starts to see the breathing, see it, mind knows the breathing, that it starts to experience delightful. You know, it's the breath going in, breath going out, but now it's a happy, delightful, enjoyable breath. When that kind of happens, for want of a better word, I often call that the tipping point of meditation. Because once the joy starts to come up, you don't need to put effort in anymore. You don't need to struggle, to strive. You don't need to ask, you know, how long must I sit meditation for? Instead you ask, do I have to get out now? Can I stay a bit longer, please? The tipping point comes and meditation starts to become incredibly attractive. You want to do it, and you can see just the benefit in this moment, let alone the benefits coming afterwards. It becomes enjoyable. The lotus petals are now very beautiful and very fragrant. You can just watch that or just enjoy that all day. So, the lotus has opened up to the delightful breathing. And that delightful breath, the delight gets stronger and stronger and stronger. And then that delight opens up. And you know what's inside there? The nimitta petals. People say, where is the nimitta? Where does it belong? It's right inside the delightful breath. Just the joy gets stronger and stronger, and then these beautiful lights come to you. Yeah, there's lots of sometimes history and stuff and complications, you know, when you first get to know these nimittas. But after a while, they become much more simple. Just the breath just coming up, just a light coming up, and you can enjoy it to the max. It's our reactions to it are usually the problems. You know, sometimes that is so beautiful, and I've been talking so much about it. This is one of the problems coming to my retreats. I sometimes oversell these experiences. If I sell them too much, then want. Or excitement. Yes. Instead, remember, these are just petals in the lotus. There's more petals inside of this one. And after a while, it settles down, fully opens. And this is also an interesting point because I've used this simile many times to solve a problem people have. Yes, they're watching the breathing. They've got the delightful breath. They can experience the delightful breath. And sometimes the nimitta comes, but then it doesn't really stabilize and it goes away again in the delightful breath. It's like in between the delightful breath and the nimitta. And so I use that thousand petal lotus simile. The petal is half opened. It's not fully opened yet, so you can see the nimitta inside, but you can also see the delightful breath. And when people say, what should I do? Should I focus on the nimitta or focus on the delightful breath? You know what to do? Nothing. Just be mindful and be kind. That's all. And if you have enough letting go energy, then it will fully open. If not, it will close up. But then it will open up again later. So this is actually when we use those similes to notice the next thing is right inside where you are now. So then you get a nimitta stabilizes. And that's so much joy and fun. Those petals are gorgeous. Sometimes you've never seen anything like that before. It's wonderful. And then after what, they say, well, this is only nimittas. What about the jhanas? I need a jhana. How do I do that? You don't do anything. Just be mindful and be kind. It's beautiful being kind. You know, the best description I have of kindness is to be able to open the door of your heart no matter what you're observing. Beautiful nimitta or the nimitta fading away. Whatever that is, open the door of your heart with no judgment, unconditionally, just letting it be. You know, part of kindness, metta, loving kindness, is letting things be. Those two go very close together. So anyway, we are just observing this nimitta, and sometimes if you're just being aware and being kind, it opens out. And in you go. Now you're going into the jhana lands. Jhana lands is... It hasn't got any width to it. It's very sort of pointy in the sense of just no width. which is one of the reasons why it's hard to describe when you're there, but easy to describe when you come out afterwards. It's right inside the nimitta. You just allow yourself to go in. Now, sometimes, somebody told me this yesterday, sometimes they felt themselves being drawn into a tunnel. Great, let yourself go. And then after a while you just go deep into the jhanas. Sometimes, I know this one monk, I'm very close to him. You know what I mean, don't you? You're just on the edge of the jhanas, just having a lovely nimitta experience. And then it's like the jhanas are like right in front of you. Should I go in, should I not go in? Scary. At first, simply because you don't know where you're going, what's going to happen. But it's very joyful. And for some meditators, and I can't do this, too much for me. Well, it's so nice in there. No, I can't. But it's so good. No. And then you go for it. In other words, you let the joy, the bliss, overcomes the fear. So you just let it happen. You never regret that. So you have these beautiful meditations. Which particular jhana was it? Only when you come out, you should be worried about such thoughts. So I said yesterday that once a jhana is complete, you've got, you know, such a good memory of it. It's a powerful experience. Different than what you've experienced before. Powerful, stable, lasts a long time. Yeah, there is some which I call ping pong jhanas. You just go in and go out, but that's not really the full thing of a jhana. It's just, you just got a bit of a glimpse. To really be a jhana, you're in there for a long time. Deeper the jhanas, the more time you're in. There's no way you can be in some of these deep jhanas for 10 minutes or half an hour. You're in it for hours. They're so stable, so still. Sometimes it's hard to come out. That's one of the reasons why. Don't be afraid. If ever you feel you're getting close to jhanas and you're being honest about it, what you do is when you start meditating, you do this programming of mindfulness thing. You tell yourself, I've got lunch at 11 o'clock. So you say, if jhana happens, I'll come out by 11. If jhana happens, I'll come out by 11. If jhana happens, I'll come out by 11. And it's amazing how well that works. If you want to get some confidence in that, tonight, when you go to sleep, I don't know what time you intend to get up tomorrow morning, say it's 4 o'clock. Then just set your alarm clock for 4:05. That actually takes off fear. And then tell yourself, as you are laying down, ready to go to sleep, I will wake up at 4 a.m. I will wake up at 4 a.m. I will wake up at 4 a.m. Give it as much attention as you can. Say it in your own words as simply as possible. And once you've said it, forget it. Just, you know, don't even bother with it. The message has gone through. It's amazing. My first meditation retreat, I was told to do that. I'd never done anything like that before, and it worked every morning. I woke up when I told myself to wake up. And then 1 or 2 minutes on either side of that allotted time. I did have an alarm clock, I did set the alarm clock, but I never needed it. It's amazing just how your mind can take those instructions. Even sometimes, you know, I'm a monk, I've got many responsibilities. If there's something I must do, instead of like, you know, tying a piece of string around my finger or something, the trouble with that, you know, sometimes people tie a string around a finger to remember something, but then they forget why they put the string around their finger. To remember something I forgot. But instead of doing that, or writing it on a piece of paper and putting it on, you know, an office wall. Instead of doing that, you just make the resolution. I must remember to send an email to Nita in a day or two, Venerable Nita. I must remember to send him an email. It's amazing how well that works. And then in a day or two's time, oh yeah, I've got to send an email to him. Your brain, when it's well trained, is like one of these little dogs. You tell him, go and pick up the newspaper. And the dog runs after the dog, picks up the newspaper and brings it back to you. That's like my mind. That's what it does. So anyway, so you get to these jhanas, and right inside the first jhana is the second jhana. You might call it like a special case. You go inside the first jhana, and right in its centre you experience the second jhana. And the difference between the first jhana and the second jhana, different type of bliss. Each one of these jhanas, what are you watching? Are you aware of the breathing? No. You are still breathing, very, very lightly, but you're not aware of that. You're aware of this beautiful mental bliss. And you don't have to force your mind to be aware of it. It's incredibly satisfying and great fun. Fun, that's a bit of an understatement. It's like ecstasy. I know that some Christians managed to experience, in the old days anyway, Teresa of Avila and St. Francis of Assisi, they seem to have experience of the first jhana. But you know what they called it? They called it union with God. If you experience those jhanas, you know why they make that statement. Because it's like you've disappeared. Your sense of self has gone. And it's incredible bliss. And so it's not just intense pleasure, but many times that people interpret that as pure love, pure metta. Again, there's hardly any difference between the experience of pure, powerful metta and bliss. So because of that, sometimes people feel that they've had union with God. And I always say that's really rough on the Buddhists. Because if any one of you had experience of a first jhana, they would name a school after you. They'd name a hospital after you. St. Prem's Hospital. But anyway, not into that sort of stuff anyway. So, when you experience that first jhana, it's a certain type of bliss. And the second jhana, you go deeper in. And it's, you know, the bliss of a second jhana is the bliss of perfect stillness. They call it samadhija, piti sukha. But not of concentration, of stillness. And I'll let you know, just that's where your will vanished. There's nothing, you can't move. There's nothing to do the moving. So you're incredibly stable. And that's a different type of bliss. And then the third jhana, the quality of that bliss called piti, which is a rough aspect of the bliss, that vanishes. An even better form of bliss. That's why it's weird. But if you get into one of those jhanas, then often you think, wow, this is it. There's nothing higher than this. Union with God is nothing higher than that. Exactly, nothing is much higher than God. In other words, there's other blisses to come. And that's weird because it's like you climb a mountain, you feel it's the biggest mountain in the world. And once at the top from there, you can see there's another one, even higher. And this is what you do. And then go inside the second jhana, right in the middle you find the third jhana. And right in the middle of the third jhana you find the fourth. The lotuses are opening up, petals by petals. And it's amazing what you find inside. And in that fourth jhana, that is this contentment. Sometimes they call it upeka, but that doesn't seem to meet the bliss of such stillness. Yeah, bliss is supposed to have already vanished, but even the Buddha said, upeka sukha. Yeah, kind of the usual type of bliss is gone, but this is an even more refined bliss. And that is the fulfillment, the perfection of mindfulness. Sati parisuddhi. The mindfulness is the best mindfulness you can ever experience in the fourth jhana. So if you want to know what mindfulness is, really is, experience the fourth jhana and you see its perfection. And then after that, we have what we call the arupas. Right in the middle of the fourth jhana, you find the first arupa. What actually are these arupa states? This is where your mind is starting to vanish. Bits of it are falling off. That's why it's quite scary for me to... Your body's already gone by the fourth jhana. Now your mind is vanishing. Even in the second jhana, you realize that part of your sense of self called the will, that's gone. And now what happens is your knowing starts to vanish. Stage by stage, the first arupa to the second to the third, even to the fourth. I'm running out of time. Even in the fourth arupa state, neither perception nor non-perception. What on earth does that mean? Are you aware or are you not aware? You have to be one or the other. And the point is, your sense of knowing has almost stopped. From this end, you see that you're not knowing anything at all, the mind is gone, stopped. From this end, you know it's stopped. So it depends on which way you look at it. But then that doesn't last long. And then that stops. Sabbe vedyata nirodha. No, was it? I got that wrong. Everything which is perceived or known ceases. Or which is perceived or experienced ceases. The mind stops. It starts again afterwards, but it stops for a while. Now you know that cannot be yours. You know that the will isn't you. Yeah, I can explain that to you. Psychologists and psychiatrists can do experiments to prove that, but when you experience it for yourself, that's something totally different. So these are experiences which give you the data to get real insight into the nature of things. And it's also scary, but very, very pleasant. Which is weird, because most scary things are unpleasant. This is the joy, the bliss, the delight in this whole process. Just draws you through. You're already quiet now. But anyway, I think that's enough for today. It's almost 9 o'clock and we do have interviews now. But I'm sure you will have some questions for me this evening, and we'll try to do as much as we can this evening to answer any questions further. The one thing which I never got onto this time was the insights which come from this. That'll be the subject for tomorrow. You might say, well, yeah, you had wonderful experiences, but is that what meditation's all about, just to have fun? No, of course not. With that joy, you have powerful minds, and then you break through and see things you never expected to see, which is so true. So anyway, that's coming in a theatre close to you soon. So... sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Very good.